Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Ron Layton, Deputy Chief Information Officer at the U.S. Secret Service. Also joining us from IBM is Melinda Balthrop. So, Ron, before we get into specific initiatives and priorities, perhaps you can give us some context. Would you describe for us what is cyberspace, what is cybercrime, and would you elaborate on the role the Secret Service plays in combating cybercrime?
Sure. So cyberspace is generally considered to be, or is referred to, the interconnection of computing systems in devices and the infrastructure that connects all of these things together. Cybercrime is generally referred to as the illegal use of computers to unlawfully access systems. And, you know, in terms of threats and the Secret Service role, if you remember back to the first question, you know, we talked about the Secret Service being formed to suppress counterfeit currency. Our roots are really in financial crime. But what has happened over time is that all of the general paper crimes, check forgery, breaking into mailboxes and stealing documentation to use it for illicit gain, all of those things have morphed into an electronic environment. So the mailbox that used to be outside of your house that had a paycheck or had some correspondence in it, well, now all of those things are done from a digital perspective. So the Secret Service had to build capability to be able to address those threats in this current environment. So in terms of specific capabilities of some of the threat actors, you know, today's software tools used for illegal purposes, the software tools that you can get off the shelf today, 10 or 15 years ago, would have been highly classified. And so a bad guy today, and I'm gonna get into a little technical jargon and then I'm going to explain it. So there's this thing called a denial of service attack. Someone can use a 300 gig UDP flood with 10 to 15 servers, that just means 10 to 15 computers, to flood your communication system, rendering it inoperable. So a denial of service attack is kind of like a bathtub that has a capacity to take 50 gallons. Well, there's enough computing power out there to be able to dump many, many gallons in the thousands in this same bathtub. And you end up saying, well, I don't have a bunch of computers to be able to do this myself. That's fine. The bad guys will lease them to you. So the point is that if you have the money, there is someone out there who will rent you the capability. And that's the one thing that's kind of changed in the last 5 years, is that you don't have to be the person behind the keyboard. You can go out and rent that person. You can rent that illicit service for a fee.
So, Ron, what are your key strategic priorities? Could you elaborate on those?
Sure. The Secret Service, when it comes to the criminal aspect of this, is very human-centric. So as a strategic priority, we focus on the burglar rather than the tools of the burglary. So we estimate our top-tier cyber criminals number in about 300 worldwide. All are Russian-speaking, all are foreign-born, and all use Russian as an OPSEC, or operational security technique or modality. Those are the people that we focus on.
Ron, we understand the nation's cybersecurity challenge stems from actions taken by a wide array of actors. Would you elaborate on the key cybersecurity threats and challenges facing the nation? And to what extent do these challenges evolve and morph? And what's the best way to get out in front of these threats?
So I talked a little earlier about the whole idea of engagement with our users and our users coming away from the experience where they really understood. So another way to say this is that it's user engagement and education that is in fact itself a counter to a threat environment. Many times users will go places that they should not based on just poor cyber hygiene. So if you talk to software developers, they will tell you that security is not the predominant characteristic of their development. What is then? It's all about user capability. So the question becomes, can you take users every place in cyberspace and can they do it safely? Well, absolutely not. And if you believe that that's the case, then it really becomes a question of managing the risk of where the users go. And some of this really just has to be explained to the user base in terms of just general cyber education, whether it's education regarding phishing or spear phishing or the human factors that bad guys take advantage of. And so education is a big part of it. The understanding that the bad guys are really retail shoppers. You don't have to be someone, again, who has fingers on the keyboard to buy a denial of service attack or a credit card dump or even to buy hardware, these skimming devices. You can, with a very small amount of money, you can go out and purchase these things on the internet. And, you know, we need to continue to build investigative capability that stays on pace with what the bad guys are doing. If we don't, we offer our adversaries digital sanctuary, and we can't afford that as a nation.
I know you covered some of this already, but regarding cybersecurity, from a progression of technology perspective, how have we arrived to where we are today?
In 1965, Gordon Moore wrote a paper, and the paper was observations regarding transistor density on integrated circuit boards. Now, what has that evolved into? This thing called Moore's Law, which just means that transistor density doubles every 18 months to 2 years. Okay, what's that mean? This whole thing of Moore's Law, which has proven to be pretty consistent since 1965, it simply means it was about transistors, but it has now evolved to technology as a broad field, which simply means that every 18 months to 2 years, you get a new piece of technology that turns over. So it's morphed into computing speed. It's morphed into the next iteration of your phone. It's morphed into the next technological advancement and iteration of the next best thing. And that's how we've gotten here.
Would you tell us more about the Critical Systems Protection Initiative? What are the goals and objectives of this effort? And can you highlight some of the successes in this area for us?
Sure. We as an agency have noticed, in particular, in the last 20 years, a merger of physical systems and cyber systems. And so if you agree that we are living in a more networked world, think about what happens when someone who we are protecting walks into a building. When they walk into, in particular, a modern building, that building is full of networked systems that touch physical systems. Whether that system is an HVAC system, a fire suppression system, a system that involves locking mechanisms, doors moving, those kinds of things, ultimately, many of those things are controlled by the network. And so if an adversary who looked to do us harm or one of our protectees harm would use that network, we need to establish a series and a methodology to be able to counter that threat. And we use the Critical Systems Protection Initiative, also known as Critical Systems Protection, to address the network threat that touches physical systems involving our protected persons.
Hey, Ron, would you tell us more about the Dual Mission Electronic Criminal Task Force? Can you describe the key components of this approach? And what threats do you focus on, and what are the benefits derived from this effort?
Sure. So the ECTF program is coming up on a 20-year anniversary. Our first ECTF was in New York City. And here's the idea, quite simply. We take the law enforcement officers, we pair them with folks from the private sector, and we pair them with folks from academia. And if you think about it, a 20-year history in electronic crimes is pretty good. I think if you even look back the last 5 or 10 years, language like Twitter and Facebook are common, but none of this was common 20 years ago. So to be quite honest, it is an incredible experiment regarding information sharing and what comes out of that. So let me give you a example this year. Secret Service has investigated about 350 intrusions, meaning malicious software that resides on business systems for the purpose of stealing data. And the majority of those intrusions are small to medium businesses. So what the investigators have found is that there is customized software resident in some of these intrusions specifically tailored to extract data illegally. So as a result of that, we took that information and we took it to USCERT, the United States Computer Emergency Readiness Team. And a combined effort between the Secret Service and USCERT put out an advisory. Well, that advisory went to UPS, and UPS was able to find this same malicious customized code in their technological ecosystem. And as a result of getting that information timely, they were able to quarantine this event to 1% of their ecosystem, 1% of their 5,000 stores, potentially saving millions of dollars of potential loss. And that is the power of the synergies of the ECTF. Here's the other thing, too. We use the same special agents who engage in investigative activities also to do protection. We are a dual mission agency. And so we just had a brief talk about critical systems protection. It turns out that the skills that are involved in the investigation of cybercrime are many of the same skills that the agents use for critical systems protection. So if I knew how to analyze a network, if I knew how to look for vulnerabilities and I was chasing a bad guy, I could use those same skills to be able to perform our protective function with the CSP program. So it's the idea of being able to have a skill set that works and, in fact, works well in both environments. One enhances the other.
Ron, you mentioned earlier, what is SCADA technology and how does it illustrate the increasing intersection or merger between cyber and the physical systems?
Sure. So SCADA technology has been around for a while. When I say for a while, 50, 60 years. And it is an acronym. It stands for Supervisory Control and Data Acquisition. And, you know, people have a tendency to think that it's only about utilities or being able to run some, you know, a piece of equipment in some remote area that people don't go to. And that is certainly true. But that doesn't mean anything to people. So, again, trying to explain and bring to light current SCADA examples, I give you this by way of narrative. 10 or 15 years ago, it was a big deal to pull your key out of your pocket, press it, and have the doors to your car open. That was a huge thing. And so look at what occurred. You pressed that key. The key sent out a signal. There was something in the car that received that signal. And as a result, you've got this physical action that moves, that happens. You've got an actuator that moves that bar that opens your door. So that, in fact, is a SCADA system. So let's take that up to today. That same car, let's say you can't find that key. You get on your trusty smart device and you call OnStar. Somewhere in the world, someone hits a key. There's a network signal that's sent to your car and the same kind of thing happens. The doors open up. So let's talk about SCADA for the future. It's that same car, but now you're sitting in the passenger seat. That car is driverless. That is the future of SCADA. So that car is driving down the road. It is seeking information based on sensors and based on what it sees to control its direction. That's a SCADA system.
Is the cybersecurity function ready to be professionalized across the nation? We will ask Ron Leighton, Deputy Chief Information Officer at the U.S. Secret Service, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour.